It's Thursday morning on Bri Radio. And here's Politics Teacher's Question Time. Okay, good morning. I haven't pressed the fact that we need to stop there, have I? So that's the thing for this. We're back after the Easter holidays, and we've got loads to talk about. So I'm back with our normal suspects here. So morning, Bridges.
Morning.
Morning, Spinny. How are you?
Morning.
Good. Masses. We've been away for... that's still planning. I think that's pause in. There we go. And then we can reset. Sorry, that's just my post-holiday buffoonery coming through. loads to talk about. 3.5 weeks since we... Well, in fact, probably 4 weeks since we last spoke, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it will be, won't it?
Yeah, so it's a month. And oh, what a month. We've had Liberation Day. We've had the death of the Pope. We've had all sorts of things. Yeah, R.I.P. More on him later. So, where do we want to go to start with, Bridges?
Well, where do we even begin? Where do we even think about beginning? I mean, I think that it's been a relatively drama-free month.
Could have been a worse month.
Could have been. I mean, but that's quite a low bar, isn't it? Because actually, when you judge this according to like normal standards, you'd say that even this sort of relatively quiet period has actually been quite loud. But I think that it's been relatively quiet. Of course, the big thing, which was towards the beginning of this, was the tariffs and the Liberation Day, where Trump put tariffs on a whole host of global partners, including an uninhabited
penguins. Yeah, he's going after the penguins.
Antarctic island owned by the Australians. So, I mean, Mr. Smith, do you want to just explain briefly what is the point of a tariff? Because we say tariff. Tariff is the most beautiful word in history. But what is a tariff and why is Trump putting them on trade?
Yeah, so a tariff is a tax on foreign goods entering the U.S. And it's meant to stimulate the domestic economy, bring back manufacturing. Trump always kind of harkens back to, you know, the good days maybe of steel manufacturing, of the automobile industry, and he wants a return to that. It also is in lockstep with his America First foreign policy principles. So sort of bringing us back to a day in which protectionism reigns supreme, in which America can exist on its own, still possess some influence abroad, but really bring more control back to the economy. We're in a trade war with China, whom he's always gone after on the trade front. But a tariff is simply meant to have consumers look more towards American products.
And who pays the tariff?
The American consumer.
The American consumer.
They will bear the brunt of the tariff costs. And Trump,
which of course,
that.
Routinely Trump said wasn't the case. He said it was a tax on other countries, not a tax on the American consumer.
Yeah, it's simply not the case.
And it's simply not the case. And it's never been the case. It's just about the case of whether that's worth it or not to achieve what you want to achieve.
So an American that would like to purchase a microwave will now be paying 154% more on that microwave because of reciprocal tariffs?
Correct.
Between the US and China?
Correct.
Although, again, here's the thing, and this is the, you know, just yesterday, Trump had a press conference where he said, well, it's currently 154, but it's not going to end up anything like 154. That's just a negotiating position. It's not going to be zero, but maybe it will, maybe it won't, but it's going to be a better number. And China are really keen to do a deal, and I'm sure there'll be a deal. So that last ditch, that kind of bit in Zulu where they form the three lines right around the thing, it's their last ditch position of tariffs, is currently being undermined by the guy who introduced them. All the other things, there were different reciprocal tariffs on all the different countries based upon a really simplistic formula about what their trade surplus or deficit was. divided by something else. I'm no good at maths. And, it, you know, there were lots of the kind of Farageists in this country who are going, oh, we've only got 10%. This must be a Brexit bonus. No, it's because we have a trade, or America has a trade surplus with us. Mm. And what they forgot, those people, is that there's still a 25% tariff on automobiles, which is our main kind of export to the US.
And steel and aluminium.
And steel and aluminium. But he's retreated from almost every one of those positions. Everybody's now on the flat 10%.
Yeah.
With no negotiations having taken place. He said people were flocking to them, basically because the 10-year bond markets in America were just tanking and people said, you can't do this. I think...
So the bonds are is effectively government debt, isn't it, that they sell on the market to citizens or to other states. And actually, the two biggest countries that own American bonds, there's a big perception that China is the biggest owner of American bonds, but actually it isn't. The biggest owner of those bonds is Japan. Yeah. And the second largest owner of the bonds is the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And China only actually in third place.
And just before the tariffs were coming in, because he's a wise guy and he's been an international banker, he knows what happens, Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, got the Canadian state to invest billions in US Treasury bonds. And then both he and the Japanese got rid of them after the tariffs came in. Okay, so this deliberate ploy to buy up those bonds and gilts. And then to get rid of them, to force people to get around Trump to come in and do it. And I mean, I was kind of struck on this. You'll realise, I mean, you've bought a house, but you haven't sold a house yet, but you might do. But often people go into these negotiations with maximalist aims. I want £800,000 for this house. And they know that they're going to settle at £600,000, right? Or they go in deliberately low. And I think Trump's still stuck in this kind of property, you go as high as you dare or as low as you dare. And what he just simply for me, and there are still people out there who'll say, oh, you haven't read The Art of the Deal, this is 4D chess. I just think he doesn't understand that what he has done has undone a huge amount of, I think some of it is irreparable. I think some of it is reparable if it happens quickly. He has undone 80 years of American soft power and persuasion in 100 days.
Yeah.
80 years of careful investment and trust, because trust and reputation take lifetimes to build and seconds to destroy. Remember that, kids, as you go through school. But it is true. You spend ages and ages and ages doing the right thing, building up your reputation, and it just takes one moment to make people lose faith in you. Now, he's lucky that America is such a powerful country, because people will give him a lot more leeway than they would for any other country who engaged in these kind of childish shenanigans. Is that maybe being a bit strong of me?
No, I don't think so. I think the interesting thing is about what it means for global trade, global free trade, which has been a principle of American foreign policy since the 1990s, specifically. The policy of free trade with China has been the policy since Nixon, hasn't it? Where you tried to bring China into the fold so that you've got a China that's on side, as opposed to a China that is sort of allied with the Soviets. And I know that sort of that hasn't probably worked, but nonetheless, the last 100 days has seen a pretty significant about turn in American foreign policy and American views on the world. And I think what it asks difficult questions about is sort of the future of globalization, if actors are going to be as volatile as they have been. I think globalization has been allowed to flourish because of sort of a steadfast commitment to it by China and the United States. But if you take one of those two actors that are sort of setting the conditions for that free trade, and you take them out of the equation, well, what does that mean for the rest of the international system? Because if you can't rely on states to live up to their side of the bargain in trade and in globalization, then you're going to have to start looking after yourself. You know, China putting a pause on the export of the 7 rare earth minerals in response to the tariffs is really significant, because actually the rest of the world is saying, well, why are you doing that to us? We haven't put tariffs on you. Why are you now reducing our ability to access your market to these materials? And that becomes really difficult. And then you see the UK government respond? Because the UK government, in turn, has effectively taken ownership of the UK's last virgin steel producing plant, which is in Scunthorpe in Lincolnshire, and actually in part because that's owned by the Chinese, and the Chinese have said, well, it's not profitable for us and we're going to shut it down. And the government are saying, well, who's going to make our steel for our ships that we're going to need in this increasingly volatile world? So the government now have taken ownership, or effectively de facto ownership, over a steel plant because they can't rely on those global relationships and those global partnerships anymore in the way that perhaps we were able to. And Starmer keeps saying how a world has changed and the world has changed and the world has changed. Now, I do believe that to a certain extent that Starmer is very good at talking and actually doesn't really provide much evidence of things after the fact. But he's got a point, hasn't he? Globalisation is on ice?
I don't think so, actually. I just think it's going to be a different kind of globalisation. The fact is that internationally businesses are interconnected and interdependent. That's not going to change in 10, 20 years. Okay, the extent to which bits for various things are made in different countries. And of course, we've got organisations like ASAEN who, where are they going to go to now? What I fear from this, actually, is that, business and trade needs stability. And it doesn't actually matter to people what the political colour of that stability is. If China becomes the global stabiliser, if China becomes the place where people invest, if the yuan, which I don't think it will, takes over from the dollar as the international reserve currency, because the US is seen as just a risky investment, why would you invest your money in America under a Trump administration? Why would you do it? And there's all the domestic stuff happening and, universities being gone after and people being deported off the streets. Why would you go to a university there at the moment if you weren't a white Caucasian European? Why would you take your money there? Why would you, when things could just change at the drop of a hat? And, the one thing that people do not like is inconsistency and instability. And those are two things that define MAGA. Its whole USP are both of those things. Instability and, sort of recklessness, throw everything against the wall. So, and I think, Trump going toe-to-toe with China. We've talked before about how China's demographics are looking pretty dodgy over the next sort of 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is, though, with this fight, is that I think the Chinese can absorb a hell of a lot more pain than the Americans have. They're used to it.
Yeah.
They're used to pain. Look at their zero COVID policy that kept people locked in their houses for years. They don't have to worry about midterms. They don't have to worry about town hall meetings. They don't have to worry about the 2028 election because that's already set in stone. Mm-hmm. They've got a huge amount of US government debt been bought up by China. I know there are other countries as well. I think it's like going into a face-slapping competition with somebody who's had local anaesthetic, right?
Do you come up with that on the fly?
I don't know. I just think of that. But it is that you can slap him in the face so many times, it's not going to make a difference.
I know. I don't know what Trump was expecting in his cabinet when playing hardball with China, expecting China to roll over in the tariff war. And that's when we were talking about Hegseth, or the response to Hegseth, and basically saying, we'll fight to whichever end.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what they were expecting from China.
They're expecting them to give in.
Yeah.
I think it's a poor
understanding from a foreign policy standpoint, just a complete lack of recognition of the Chinese economy, of the way the G operates, and look where we are now. So
I think they've got a fatal overestimation of U.S. power.
Uh-huh.
And U.S. is by far and away the most powerful country in the world, but it's not powerful than all the others.
Yeah.
Right? In combination. And by punishing allies first and enemies second. I mean, still, countries who don't appear on Trump's tariff list, Russia, Belarus, North Korea.
Yeah.
Right? They're not on his tariff list.
But the penguin inhabited island that belongs to Australia
what
is
called now.
No, I can't.
I bet he taxed North Sentinel Island too. That's the
But look at how, I mean, this is the thing. Look at how quickly it's all unraveled.
Yeah.
The whole world, apart from China, is now on 10%.
Yeah.
Which will be retreated from as well. So he's gone massive. And I think...
But the damage is, like you said, the damage is done. And so I was reading this morning. So the shutdown in global trade, well, from China to US trade, it happened about the 10th of April, where factory output dropped significantly. And container output dropped significantly in the 10th of April. And it takes 30 days for those containers to go from China to LA, 45 to get to Houston, 45 to Chicago, and 55 to New York. So we are effectively not going to see the impacts of that initial tariff announcement until the 10th of May. And that's a long time.
Yeah.
And that's like the earliest. That's sort of the shelves in shops in LA are going to start to run dry on the 10th of May. And in New York, the impact of that isn't going to be felt until sort of the middle of May, towards the end of May. And so therefore, even if now Trump were to and Xi were able to get trade going as to a level that it was prior to the 10th of April, it's going to take until probably the end of June for stock to get back to normal levels in Target and Walmart in New York State. And that's significant, isn't it? And this is the implications of the international system. I mean, selfishly, I'm going to America in the summer. I'm very much looking forward to going to Bass Pro Memphis.
I hope their prices aren't affected.
And I hope that their stock and prices are not affected. But that's the world that we live in, because the majority of the stock that will sit in Bass Pro for good patriots to buy and go fishing with comes from China.
Yeah.
Just like most of the cheap consumer goods,
like MAGA hats, right?
MAGA hats.
MAGA hats are made in China. Awesome.
MAGA cups.
MAGA cups.
I saw this thing on Instagram. Could have been fake. Probably was fake. But they'd stuck all the stickers that had said sort of the Trump stickers, the price tag stickers on Trump Yetis. They're not Yetis, but they're the knockoff Yetis. And it said designed in Oregon. But then when you took the sticker off, it said made in China. Classic.
I just think it's not surprising, this, when you look at the team that Trump has put around him, that he's had to, because he's only got loyalists and he only wants loyalists. There's only really one person who knows anything about anything, which is Rubio. Now, my bet that he would walk by now hasn't come true, so I'll hold my hand up. I've lost on that. I still don't think it'll be long, but we've got stuff that's happened again with Hegseth. This is somebody who is unsuited to office. He's too young. He's too inexperienced. Witkoff, who's bumbling around the Middle East and went into the Elysee Palace in Paris and said, oh, this is like Mar-a-Lago. Now, the Elysee Palace was built before the American Revolution, I think, and you know, it's got lots of empire stuff. When these people, they're not serious people. they're not serious people, but they still think that the only country that can have pride and not back down and be, you know, true to itself is the States. And you know, do they really think that Xi Jinping, the strong man of a country of however many billion people, is just going to go, yeah, okay then, Donald, I'll give in to you? Do they really think that? Do they really think that the Ukrainians are just going to say, oh, yeah, okay, just because you say they can have these four or five oblasts of Ukraine.
And
of
Crimea.
Course.
Yeah.
Well, come on
they're
then.
Yeah.
Come on then, Trump. Are you going to give up Florida? If, you know, oh, no, I go down. Blah, blah, blah. Well, why do you expect other people to give up their territory?
Right.
Just because you say so. They massively overestimate American strength.
Yeah.
Economically and militarily.
You know, every action seemed, or every response from the White House seems to be worse and seems to snowball. But that recognition of Crimea as Russian territory, just completely breaking post-World War II order, is pretty
diabolical. And also, Ukraine can't, Zelensky can't accept it because it's not within the Constitution. Yeah, and that's not going to happen.
And the fact is, right, that even if they get their will, Trump gets his wish and Putin gets his wish, and Zelensky steps down from power, who's the guy in waiting? Zeluzhny, right? Yeah. Who's the commander, the military commander at the beginning of the war, who's even more hardline pro-Ukraine than Zelensky is.
Yeah.
So it's not like the Ukrainian people are going to say, "Oh, okay, yeah, we'll vote in a Russian puppet because that's what you want us to do."
No, you're going to get someone much more hardline who actually he's the Ukrainian ambassador to the UK at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, Oleg Zhelezny, yeah. So it's all about, for me, it's all about a short-term headline that then needs to be retreated from.
It's a quick...
How long, Smithy, sorry, this is for you, how long are the Republican Party going to put up with this? How long is the system? We've had a 9-0 Supreme Court ruling against him and then a 7-2, with the only two being Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito.
I mean, the 9-0 is a pretty significant...
Yeah, that's telling.
This is about deporting people. And he's defying them at the moment. He's defying Congress. He's defying, how long is it going to take? We're 100 days in.
Yeah.
When are they going to take serious action?
The Supreme Court step is big. And a little bit of faith is restored on that front. Still, I have serious doubts about the Senate. If you watch any of the hearings, could have been around the Hegseth hearing, those aren't serious politicians either, in my opinion. No. Some of those GOPers. John Kennedy, he asks ridiculous questions. I mean, there's a whole list. Tommy Tuberville, I don't know if you're familiar with him. American football coach, as far right as you can get. They are not serious. They are essentially loyalists. The grassroots movements, how powerful are they? Are they in the face of pressure groups like the NRA or, you know, other groups in Washington? I don't know. But I keep seeing or hearing things that, you know, people are upset that Republicans are starting to turn the corner, but I'm not convinced yet. I'm not as optimistic.
But when you say loyalists, do you think they're actually loyalists to some kind of MAGA creed, or are they just on it for the ride?
Is there a difference? Does it really matter? I mean, they're just suckling at the teat of power for the next 3 years, and they'll probably change their opinion back to there's no chance the Republicans would win on a moderate Republican in 2028. It would be a Democrat or it would be another MAGA manipulator. But at this point, it's like, what's the difference? You know, you're going to be on the wrong side of history, regardless of what happens. And I think there was something, it was one senator maybe, spoke out against, could it have been the Russian Crimea situation? Something that, you know, should have had plenty of backlash. There's very few vocal senators on the Republican side. I quickly wanted to go over, sorry, this is a segue, but Musk is on his way out. He's told investors that he's focusing on Tesla. Tesla's profits have plummeted. He has...
And it's like 40%. A 40% drop in profit.
I think it might be 70.
Wow.
So he has destroyed his reputation. He has destroyed American government. He has destroyed his company. All in the span of 3 months.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
It's unbelievable.
And what we're teetering on the edge of now. Sorry, were you going
to
finish?
I was going to say that it has spiraled to the point of him essentially trying to have a Tesla showroom on the White House lawn, having Trump step into it and say, everything's computer. Did he see that?
Trump doesn't drive, does he?
Trump gets it. No, he hasn't driven probably since 1970. And he gets in and he goes, everything's computer. And it's just like a Tesla advert in the middle of the White House lawn.
It's just amazing.
Just as a PR stunt. But everyone's going to buy Chinese EVs.
Oh, they're
taking
good.
Over
they're
Teslas.
They're everywhere in the UK at the moment. BYD. Yeah, they are...
Apparently, much more so in like France and not Germany so much, but other parts, because they're 40% cheaper.
Yeah,
even with the tariff that the EU have put on them,
liberals don't want to buy Tesla. It used to be you buy it because Elon is sort of this innovator, this disruptor.
And Democrat,
plus, you buy
right?
it, yeah, and you buy an electric car, and now it's probably
it's a swastika car.
Yeah, exactly. It blows my mind. Yeah, as a leader of a company,
and the thing that's teetering on the edge right now is this thing about what Trump's going to do about Jerome Powell, like the head of the Federal Reserve.
Oh, that's right.
Who he's making noises about getting rid of, which he's not constitutionally allowed to do. Mm-mm. And actually, he appointed him. People think that if he does that, the markets are just going to tumble even further because it shows direct political interference in the US economy in a way that hasn't existed.
Well, the gold reached record highs 3 days ago when it looked like he was going to try and get rid of Powell.
Gold's where you go when you don't feel safe investing in government bonds. There is a kind of precedent for this, 1971, and actually Nixon forced, can't remember his name, Browning, something like that, the head of the Federal Reserve, to reduce interest rates. But it led to massive inflation. It took a decade to recover from that political decision because people saw that. Obviously, Nixon didn't last that much longer. But...
What a guy Nixon was.
He was a fantastic diplomat.
But quite exceptional, isn't it? So many parallels between Nixon and Trump in terms of their sort of belligerence and their sort of the lack of recognition for rules and norms.
Well, let's just hope there's a similarity in there in terms of leaving office in race.
Yeah.
Before we move on, can I just talk about Harvard briefly?
Yeah, go. Yeah.
So I think that this is interesting. And obviously what Trump is threatening is not constitutionally protected. It would be fought in the courts. Harvard would win. He wants to block all international students from attending Harvard.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't really read Trump into wants that to do too that. Much.
And I think it's 20% of Harvard's enrollment. Granted, their endowment is, you know, in the hundreds of billions, and they can bear a great cost, but he'll never be able to do that. The fact that he's even proposing that is lunacy. Also, he is threatening to cut them off from federal grants, which they'll need for research. I think even these schools with deep pockets still need that money. And he's essentially trying to extract concessions in curricula. So he wants them to scrap, you know, maybe a gender studies course, other things that he believes are a part of the woke agenda. So he's trying to strong arm America's most historic and essentially a soft power institution in
well,
and of itself.
Well, universities are absolutely critical in democracies, aren't they? And especially in the UK and the US, where we have significant scientific advantage in pharmaceuticals and research. And actually, a lot of that comes from federal and in the UK from state funding. And if you don't provide it, it's a real challenge. And this is this similar issue in the UK with the weakness of the universities at the moment and the peril in that sector is actually it's so significant for the UK economy and UK soft power that these universities are strong. And actually, Trump going after Harvard is an absolute disaster. It's a disaster for the American economy, for American soft power, but for the quality of research that comes out of that university and actually the lives that have been saved across the world because of research that comes out of Harvard is incalculable.
I think I'm right in saying that a lot, if not most, of the federal funding for these big universities goes into their medical wing because all these big... I mean, universities, I think it's fair to say, in America are much bigger. I mean... I think Harvard's got $54 billion endowments or something. It's huge.
Bigger, yeah.
So actually all those kind of gender studies things are going to be protected by endowments. They don't need federal spending. But the ones that do are these massive hospitals that they use for training of doctors and for medical research. And, you know, again, you know, we'll come back to our friend Mr. Musk. You know, why is he in the States? Because he... emigrated there and was allowed to, you know, exercise freedom of being an entrepreneur and all of that. And, you know, what holds up Silicon Valley? What natural born Americans who've come from Tennessee and Mississippi or people from India and China and Taiwan, whatever, who come in? I mean, obviously there are homegrown guys as well. Yeah. I'm not trying to be trite in this, but if you cut off that, if you suddenly said that UK universities couldn't take foreign students, they'd all be closed in a month.
Yeah, it's, same with America.
It's utter lunacy once again, and just
because they pay full. A lot of them pay full freight, you know, because they're not subject to federal and state financial aid packages. So it makes it so a student would pay 60,000 quid, maybe more, a year to go to a Harvard. So they can take those, then they can give bursaries to other students.
What would happen to the NFL program, man?
The what?
And the NBA.
Oh, yeah.
If there weren't people paying above the odds so they could give those athletic bursaries to people to come in and scholarships, American professional sport would die.
That's a whole... This is going to be such a quick tangent, but have you heard that they can... This is something that I follow so closely, that you can pay athletes millions of dollars now in university athletics in the States. So kids are asking for millions, and there aren't legally binding contracts, so they'll... pull out the rug from a school and just leave to another one if there's a higher bidder.
Really?
It's like professional sports.
I think it's probably also worth it, and we probably ought to leave America in a minute and go poping, maybe. Should we go poping next?
Yeah,
maybe?
Let's go. Let's.
But it's just worth saying before we leave this, and this comes back to the whole thing about tariffs and Musk and whatever. The US is a society that's much more tied into stocks and shares than UK.
Yeah, that's
I think
good
something
point.
Like 35% of people are kind of retirees are reliant on it. I think in America it's something like 60-65%. Their incomes are in some way and institutions directly linked to the stock market. So, you know, again, that's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, my IRA is in trouble. It's my retirement
and lots
account.
Of people's 401ks, right? Are just you
what
know,
is 401k?
It's like a
an employer will match your contribution to
it's like our okay. It's like our pensions before right. we took them away.
All right.
Different ones. But yeah, the employer pays a bit, you pay a bit, and it means that you can retire at a certain age with a certain amount of investment in the market.
But the value of that is tied to the value of the
exactly
market.
Exactly so. As actually pumped. Are a lot of pensions for...
In the UK.
Particularly state pensions in the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like an aggregate of the top 500 stock, the S&P 500.
Right, let's very quickly go poping, and then what are we going, Kashmir?
Yeah, let's do a little bit of that.
And so, we've done a little bit.
And then the truce.
Pope Francis died on Easter Monday. Poor lad, the last sort of senior official he met was J.D. Vance, although somebody told me he sent a cardinal out to speak to him to give him a bit of a lecture about what it meant to be a good Catholic, because the Pope obviously wasn't exchanging a lot of words by then. We're now going to go into something, there's been a film about it recently called A Conclave, which is where basically cardinals are locked in until they make a decision. Interestingly, I hadn't clocked this until yesterday, 100 cardinals out of 250 are not allowed to be part of that conclave because they're over 80.
Yeah.
So anybody over 80 does not have a say in that.
So the UK has two cardinals that will vote. One of them is over 80, so can't vote. The other one is 79, so won't be able to next time round. Yeah, so two front runners. One is, I can't remember the names, sorry.
Sarah?
No, one's from Africa. And one's from...
Are they called the Preferiti? Is that the name of the popes in waiting?
Preferiti, I think. Yeah,
and one from the Philippines. So they could have the first Asian pope and could have the first African pope. But there is already sort of like talk coming out of some of the cardinals about what will happen to the split of the Catholic Church if there is another liberal pope.
Point of tedious historical order, Mr. Bridges. Mm. There was one from Africa in the early Roman era. Okay. I think he was from Libya. So, anyway.
Okay.
Sorry.
That is me put bang to rights by
no, it's
historian.
Just me being a tedious historian, that's all.
But so that'd be really interesting because sort of if you look at global politics and global trends, the right has sort of starting to become quite dominant, hasn't it? So it'd be interesting to see whether the cardinals go with the general trend in the international system or whether they buck the trend somewhat by going for the more liberal candidates,
yeah,
particularly the liberal candidate from the Philippines, which I think is going to be really interesting, whether the really super conservative with a small C Catholic Church has got it in it to vote for somebody that isn't of white European descent into that high papal position.
Yeah, I think the fact that a lot of those cardinals were appointed by Pope Francis might have and he was very much seen on the more sort of liberal side of the Catholic Church. People will be looking at this and looking at the cover in the news and saying, why is this such a big deal? Okay, there's about just over a billion Catholics, I think, in the world, in about 130 different countries. They have one of the best information gathering secret services in the world.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're not a kind of active secret service like MI5 or the CIA or MI6, but information gathering, they've got people everywhere.
Yeah.
And they've got a really serious sort of, you know, when people want a little bit of inside knowledge, they go to the Vatican. But also, the fastest growing religious take-up in Britain is young men joining the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I was going to talk
and
about
we've talked about, you know, young men beginning to become more right-wing. You know, the Catholic Church obviously is very much, you know, reinforcing the male position in society and stuff like that. So it's actually quite a big deal, much bigger deal than we might think, just thinking some old Argentinian guy has died. This is a really powerful position.
On the backdrop of a growing a religious revival, they're calling it, and Easter Sunday has some record numbers for recent times in British churches, both Anglican and Catholic. And I think so there is sort of a religious revival that sort of sits alongside this, isn't there? And there's a general interest in religion in the Catholic Church. And of course, Catholicism in the UK has been growing since at least 2004 when Poland joined Schengen. And Poland, and you know, between 2004 and 2010, over a million Polish people arrived in the UK, and they brought their Catholicism with them, and the Catholic Church has been growing in the UK since. So I think it's a really interesting point. Of course, the Catholic Church is the traditional church of England.
Mm-hmm.
For the majority of England's... Oh, are we getting into... Yeah, I guess for the majority of England's history, England was a Catholic country. It's only been... A 500-year hiatus, and England was established in 927, and Catholic Church ended with Henry VIII. So England's probably been a Catholic country longer than it's been an Anglican country. So it is a tradition of Europe, and I think it'll be interesting to see where they go. But all this happens quite quickly, doesn't it? The funeral is going to be at the weekend.
Yeah.
After the funeral, the conclave will begin, and then the famous quote about the cliche of the white smoke will begin. And every day,
we can't ignore coming back to Trump, can we? Did you see his post on Truth Social where he said, "I'm really looking forward to going to the funeral of the Pope," and he put an Easter bunny emoji on the side of it. Words fail me.
Didn't he when the Pope was announced, he was doing his Easter speech, wasn't he? And he mentioned it in that, and there was an Easter bunny stood next to him.
Yes.
I wouldn't put it past him. Do you remember when John Boehner, Speaker of the House, when Pope Francis came to the White House, or came to Congress, and John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, was just like visibly emotional behind Pope Francis, and like what a, you know, Boehner was pretty right on the political spectrum, and now it's like what a far cry we are from that. It's just so unserious, like going on Truth Social with an Easter bunny emoji talking about the Pope who just passed away.
I also think it's still an interesting that he doesn't use Twitter. He still continues to use Truth Social, even though his best mate Musk is the man with the keys.
Not best mate anymore. There's a lunch that depends on this.
Yes. you are needing that lunch.
Okay, so conclave. Should we shift to Kashmir?
Yeah. Kashmir.
Yeah, we've got five. We've got
9 minutes.
Do you want to kick us off that, Smithy?
I'm not too in the weeds on the details here, but 20-some people killed in Kashmir. It's only upped tensions that have existed in that region for
70
I don't know
years.
How long. Yep, Indian administered territory. I think a lot of the victims were Hindu men, which is going to, you know, continue the conversation of whether this was a targeted attack. But yeah, this is a highly volatile region, and certainly an area where you hope that conflict would not arise.
Yes, heavily nuclear-armed states.
Heavily disputed.
Not the place for there to be.
Flashpoints is the one that causes people sleepless nights, isn't it? It's the one that concern people probably more than anything. Kashmir region... between India and Pakistan, that's disputed, neither control, well, bits, each of them control bits of it, both want all of it. And it is a legacy of empire and colonialism, this region in Kashmir, and who owns it. Sort of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, once a homogenous part of the British Raj, and then obviously were partitioned into East,
the Mughal Empire.
And then partitioned, and Pakistan became largely Islamic country. India, largely Hindu country. And so this is pretty bad. And for this to take place when J.D. Vance is in country as well is significant. I think it's symbolic. India have immediately...
Do you think it's connected?
Wait, what? He was in...
J.D. Vance is in India at the moment,
His wife's of Indian descent.
That's right. Everything he touches, though, has been followed up by...
Yeah, the Greenland trip went well.
The Vatican trip went well.
We'd forgotten about Greenland, hadn't we?
Kashmir's gone well. India have instinctively blamed Islamists for the attack, and they have blamed the Pakistanis for permitting the attack to take place. So they've shut the border between India and Pakistan.
Diplomats have been yanked.
Diplomats have been pulled out. They've revoked all visas that they've given for Pakistanis in India, so they've all got to go back to Pakistan. It's a significant global moment.
Last time something like this happened, or more people died with those, was it Mumbai hotels? And the Pakistani militants sort of came over and basically went round this hotel hunting people down and gunning them down in a fairly... And again, the Pakistanis blamed, you know, sort of splinter groups. The Indians said that actually it's the ISI, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Pakistani Secret Service were behind it.
Who are a highly effective organisation.
Now, let's just explode this to a little bit more of a geopolitical thing, right? Pakistan is deep in cahoots with China on their Belt and Road Initiative, and those trade routes are going through there to Gwalior, big port.
The big deep port.
Big port. India's basically rising as a rival to China, so we've now got potentially three nuclear powers involved. We don't want to depress everyone on a Thursday, do we? But, you know, it does seem like one of the sort of results of all this international chaos may be that countries like Japan, South Korea, Poland seek a nuclear deterrent because they feel they can't rely on the nuclear deterrent they were previously reliant upon.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Nuclear proliferation could still... Now, maybe that'll be a good thing because it will, you know...
More mad,
more mutually assured destruction. But it's pretty ropey at the moment.
Yeah, that is the thing. That's the ropiest of things, isn't it? Because there's so much hurt and emotion in that Kashmir region that no one thinks rationally about that. It's very difficult to pull people back from the brink when it comes to Kashmir and India and Pakistan. Yeah. And, you know, it was a couple of years ago, wasn't it, where India or Pakistan accidentally shot down one of each other's jets. And that was sort of a high risk moment. I remember David Cameron talking about how perilous that week or so was whilst they tried to talk both sides down from doing something that they probably would later regret. So that is the area where there's sort of the greatest level of risk, I think. So that's the one thing that we're going to have to look. And historically, of course, you would have America as the key mediators in there trying to de-escalate that. You know,
you think Witkoff is equipped for
the Secretary of State? Secretary of State would be there. They would be there right now, and they'd be trying to talk both sides down from doing something really silly. But this will be the long term consequence of American power decreasing. Can you rely on America to get this de-escalated and to calm this thing down? So let's hope that that doesn't become much worse over the next week or so.
And when you've got your Sec Defense putting out on a
second chat with his wife and brother,
but they reckon there are more than 20 different groups now.
It's personal cell phone as well. So the man who runs
can you remember Clinton's
biggest
emails?
Yeah,
but who's going to step in there? What serious senior general is going to step into that position?
No one. I mean, not a one. You look at how he drove Mad Dog Mattis crazy. He drove who else? Even John Bolton, you know, who is
Mark Milley.
Yeah, any general or person who was on the Joint Chiefs.
Any serious person,
longtime military person, has nothing but bad things to say about him and would not work for him again. So, how many MAGA loyalists are you going to find who are serious Army, Navy, Marine veterans in the Joint Chiefs who will work for the guy? So that's why you're facing a Pete Hegseth situation, and Trump has defended him until the bitter end and has pawned it off on, you know, disgruntled employees who are coming out. And there's been loyalists who are resigning saying these things about Hegseth and saying it's been a month of hell.
All fake news. That's what Caroline Levitt has been saying.
Saying it was a month out of hell.
Was it Vance or Hegseth who said that the invasion of Iraq was Europe's fault last week?
That was Vance, wasn't it?
Or it might was have been Europe, Hegseth, Europe who
that's certainly
pushed
a take
into the Iraq war.
Should we talk briefly about Russia-Ukraine the next
week? Let's leave that for next week, shall we? Because the it's not clear yet what this ceasefire is going to look like or what the peace deal is going to be.
Will be a ceasefire
and then we can interrogate that next week.
What we do know, and we'll see how this pans out next week, is it looks as if the Russian summer offensive is already floundering in a couple of places. But yeah, we'll be in a better position to see that next week. There's something cheery to look forward to, isn't there? Now, this might jump to halfway through a song because I'm inept and I've just come back from holiday. But we'll see you next week for more Politics Useless Question Time. Cheers, all.
Adios.
Cheers.
Adios.